You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. It's my extremely great honour to have in the studio today Professor Cedric Villani. Hello, Cedric. Welcome.
Hello, Karen.
The reason I have Cedric here today is, of course, that it is an extremely unusual honour to have a Fields medalist in the studio at any time, but even more so when he has written a book as delightful, as literary, as surprising and inspiring as his book, Birth of a Theorem. This book is translated from the French by Malcolm de Beauvoir, and if you look at the back of the book, you will begin to realise why Cedric Villani is as extraordinary as he is, should the Fields Medal not tell you already. It's endorsed on the back by a fellow mathematician, Jordan Ellenberg, and poet and rock legend, Patti Smith. This is a singular academic. He is the director of the Institut Henri Poincaré in Paris, professor of mathematics at Claude Bernard University in Lyon, winner, as I've said, of the Fields Medal for proofs of nonlinear Landau damping and convergence to equilibrium for the Boltzmann equation. He's also winner of the Fermat Prize, the Henri Poincaré Prize, and the Jacques Herbrand Prize. And this work, for which he won the Fields Medal, was done with his colleague Clément Mour. Cedric, one of the things that struck me about this book was that in and around your story of your discovery, we have many lovely portraits of other great minds in the past. Fermat, Newton, Monge, Fourier, Boltzmann, John Nash, and then contemporary colleagues like your late colleague Michel Schatzman, Luc Tartar, Grégory Perelman, who refused the Fields Medal, Paul Malliavin, Gabor de Mocos, and Elliot Lieb, who was critical of your work. Are you interested in people? Are you interested in people generally, mathematicians specifically?
Well, I am interested in people generally, and always very quick to get some empathy with people, that's for sure. Maybe it has also to do with my past as a very shy child. But apart from that, mathematics and science is all about people. I mean, that's one of the most important things conveyed, I hope, from the book. It's not just your work alone, or it's not even your work of you and your collaborator. It's the whole environment, and you constantly have this exchange with the other people, with your colleagues, with the people from other laboratories, and especially in mathematics, where it is all about ideas. We spend so much time talking to each other, talking about each other's ideas, talking about the ideas of great people from the past. So the people from the past that you mention, we live with them, we live with their ideas, but also the people from the present. We constantly live with them and use their ideas.
So it is very collaborative in the sense that you cannot develop your own ideas or proceed without sharing with other people.
You always need the sharing and also testing, like sound testing, where does the idea lead, what do you think about it. You were mentioning Elliot Leibs, who was quite critical about that first reception of some of my work, and then we rediscussed, and then he was less critical and so on, but with this kind of tough exchanges, you learn a lot, and that's very important. Don't think that all mathematicians collaborate together. Of course, there is also competition. You want to be the first to get this important result and so on. There is quite competition. But globally, it's a whole collaborative process, as is science. You know, when somebody gets a medal or prize, there is this usual sentence he or she is supposed to say about, I thank all my collaborators and it's been wonderful, such a team, etc. But it's not just for the record, it's true. It's true, and here the book, I think of it like it was the best thank you I could possibly say to this whole community. Not just saying the sentence, but telling about all the contributions. There was just in finding which problem was interesting, there was a contribution of that person, that other person. And in the process of making the proof, there was the idea from that person, there was the process of interaction with this other person, there was a conference there, etc. And we see also the role of the environment, there are the institutions, the fact that at some point I am in Lyon, at some point in Princeton, at some point in Paris, And all these places are important because of the different mentality, the different people, different spirits around there.
It's a very generous way to talk about your work. Obviously, we know that there is a certain part of intellectual endeavor that focuses on the great man or the great woman, with the ideas coming from their head. The awards come normally to a specific person. So it would be understandable if, when you had a book about your work, it would be more about you and less about other people. And yet on almost every page, you are writing with great generosity about the ideas of others.
I think it is fair. It's not, I would not say generosity, but it's being fair and knowing what you owe to people, especially with my style as a mathematician, always listening, where are the ideas, where is it? Some of my best results and best theorems were obtained by listening to somebody else and understanding there is connection between these two and making that connection. Some people have this style, like it looks like they are kind of above. Grigory Perelman, whom you mentioned, gives a little bit of this impression when we see this work, like coming from outer space. When he saw the Poincaré conjecture, it gave the impression of that guy, well, above the crowd. I see myself, at the contrary, at the center of the crowd, like an antenna receiving and giving from all parts of the community.
Many of the people that we meet in the book through you, I guess, make me think a little bit of what you say about Perelman, the austere, in the case of some men in their 80s who are still alert and vibrant and working. Some other figures, when you go into Princeton late at night, you see a light on and someone is still working. He works on California time in order to get more opportunities. They often seem to me like I wonder if these mathematicians also seem to other people to be these statues, very noble, but never goofy or making mistakes or silly or confused. Did they seem that way to you when you were young, when you looked at great mathematicians, that they were the les immortels, you know, these immortal figures?
Yes, certainly. As a young mathematician, I was very much impressed. And as you say, there is this impression of staunch statue, very strong and so on. When you live with them, you understand it's partly just the appearance. And even, for instance, Jean Bourguin, whom I quote and I mention as working so late at night and for sure one of the most powerful analysts of the century. And you should have seen him just before a public lecture, so afraid at the
really?
Idea of yes, so nervous and so on. We all have our moments of fragility, and it's also important when you are doing science. It's a moment of terrible exposure sometimes you are giving when you are presenting a proof and offering yourself to the appreciation and evaluation. The whole of academic life is based on evaluation by peers, and it's a very fierce process of evaluation. And we all have our moments of fragility. Still, it is true that some of these personalities can be so striking for their inner flame that never, ever vanishes year after year after year.
You've mentioned to me previously that you were quite shy when you were young and maybe not outgoing, very studious, you loved to read. Do you think those qualities of being shy has made it maybe more possible that you observe people closely and that you know perhaps when to be silent and when to be taking in what's around you?
I would be happy to answer yes, but I think that would be an overstretch.
Okay.
I think when I was a child, all these issues were quite blurred to me, you
right.
know, like rather not observing, but really not knowing what to do and so on. Let me add that I consider shyness in the present world as a kind of positive value, you know, where everybody is trying to shout louder than the other. I like it when I meet young people who don't try to impress everybody and are working more silently, let's say. And let me add that I did not really suffer from being shy at that age, but I did suffer from being told repeatedly, behave, be bold, overcome your shyness, and so on. I think first important thing with kids is to accept their personality and see where it will be leading. It certainly was quite a surprise for my teachers when they saw me as a 12-year-old kid who would be so afraid to open mouth in the classroom, and see me after that coming on television regularly, giving public lectures in front of crowds of hundreds and hundreds. Probably I, in the end, did more public outreach and so on than anybody else in the school.
What a wonderful surprise for a teacher to see this little seed inside someone they knew as 12 years old. And there's nothing more wonderful for a teacher than to say, I
Probably.
Have that boy in my class, look at him now.
And then you can, is this thanks to me?
Of course. Well, why not? There's a lovely moment in the book where you mention a Hungarian mathematician who'd paid a lot of money to attend a dinner for another and remained in Hamburg, and he remained quite silent in
That's
the front.
A wonderful connection you are making indeed, and we see here the value of shyness in this case. It is by the fact that he kept silent that he attracted the attention of Vladimir Arnold. Then, as I say in the book, Vladimir sees him again later and says, so now is the time, what do you want to tell me? And he was, in those days, the Hungarians was so poor, and so Arnold knew that the money this mathematician had to spend for the dinner was a lot of money for him. And, well, and as I explained in the book, I found this story so moving. As I explained, the few minutes of conversation that Gabor had with Arnold changed his life and put him on a journey, intellectual journey, that lasted for 12 years or so, the result of which was this shape, this extraordinary shape, the gum box, one of which is now on my desk.
I was so relieved to see that there was a mathematical concept that I could look at as a physical object.
Something concrete in this world of rude abstraction.
This book is a little bit different to many books by eminent, do you mind if I call you eminent, scientists, in that often when a very acclaimed scholar produces a book, maybe a little bit about his success or how I came to win the great prize, they tend to be popularizing books, or as we say in French, less nicely, vulgarisation, which always sounds awful, vulgarizing in English.
Awful.
Yes. But of course, naturally, many physicists, for example, or astrophysicists, chemists, will create a popular science book that explains some parts of their ideas. And that is the main part of why you would read the book, how I worked on the Large Hadron Collider, etc. And this book is quite different, in fact. Instead of trying to make the science comprehensible, and in fact, although I said this book was a translation, it's only a partial translation, isn't it? Because the text has been translated into English, but the mathematics remains
in mathematics. Yes.
And there is no, I think, possible translation for this. And so it seems to me, instead of trying to make the science comprehensible, what you've shared with us is the inspiration, the emotion, the adventure, and the passion.
Yes. This was the kind of radical choice, indeed, in the writing of the book, and the one that was most original, certainly. And as you say, when you are a scholar writing a book for the public, normally you simplify everything that is technical or put instead analogies, things that people can relate to. And I did the exact opposite choice of putting the words in the most radical possible way with no explanation for most of them, except explanations, but on the side of the human, of the history, and so on. There is no explanation for the technical concepts. And this was radical. Some of the people are just feel appalled in front of the book and they don't understand what to get from it. And the people who really have difficulty with the book are the people who try to understand and the people who do have some advanced science content, some advanced science background, and
yes,
try and understand. You should not try and understand the science in there. I think I found the best possible analogy to explain the differences. Imagine you are doing some complicated job. I don't know, you're an executive in some company, whatever, with some complicated organization going on a project, and your six-year-old child asks you what you are doing for a job. And the normal way to answer, the usual way to answer would be to do things in a simple way and use simple words that the child can relate to, analogies with how the child is playing and so on. But the other possibility is to remain silent about the significance of it all and take your child to work, and the child will be sitting near you and observing you and everything you are saying and not understanding the details, but seeing what are the moments when you are angry, moments when you are afraid, and so on. And that's that other kind of immersion into the world of the mathematician, which I strive for in Birth of the Theorem. So that book is like a journey into the exact life of the mathematician in all its features. When do we work? How do we talk to each other? What do we feel? What are our emotions? What are the moments? What is the rhythm, the pace of the discovery, and so on? So all this you find, including details such as which is the word processor that we use for mathematical formulas, how we travel, how we give lectures, and so on. And I think that is the sole book available in which all these features are. In all these features are described. You find many fine books nowadays about science applied to this and that, about the science explained to a six-year-old. But this is the book that explains about all the rest, not science in itself, but how it is done, the human side of it.
The great mystery at the heart.
The great mystery at the heart. Let me also mention that I don't think I would ever had the idea myself to write this book. And that's also an occasion to pay tribute to
Olivier.
Another of the... Yes, Olivier Nora was the director of the Grasset Publishing Company. And we met in a dinner organized at the Fondation Cartier. So it was a to Paris event in which many people versed in the intellectual life and so on were present. It was before the Fields Medal. So Olivier had not heard about me, but he was intrigued by my special dress code, and he asked around, and they told him, that's a mathematician, he's quite good at communicating, and then we had a discussion, and he said, I would like to enrich my catalogue with some mathematical, etc., and so, why don't you come and meet me at Grasset? Okay, and I came. And we discuss, and then there is this guy starting to be so friendly, making me a bit uneasy, like, where are we? What exactly will this be? Oh, it would be great if you can write. You have any ideas of project? And I had thought about it. You know, I could write a great book maybe about entropy. I'm one of the world experts and know every facet of this, such an important concept. And he really didn't care a damn. He was not interested in the technique. He was interested in just the human side. The question he asked me is, I want to know what you are doing of your days.
Wow.
What is it you are doing? And I thought carefully, how am I going to meet that request? I'm not going to say in the morning, I do this, I do that. But then I thought, you know, it's like everything. To make some story look nice and enjoyable, you have to see it as an adventure with a goal, a journey, with something that goes wrong and something that goes well. And I thought I will just tell the story of one result, one theorem, but that will be the opportunity to go through all the various stages that an academic is going through when doing his or her job.
You must have been particularly pleased that this offer came to you. Now that you look back, it came to you before the Fields Medal, because naturally, when a scholar has won something so important, everybody in the world wants you to do everything possible, reality TV, opening ice skating shows, making movies, some of which you will wish to do, some not, fashion shoots, as we know.
Yes.
This was someone who was intrigued by your ideas before you merely appeared as the great representative of France, along with another mathematician that year, winning the Fields Medal.
It was indeed a great coincidence and schedule, because indeed, after that, all the publishers, they came into my office trying and convincing me to work on this and that and so on. But the fact that I had met Olivier before meant that I could work somehow quietly on this, thinking for myself and so on. I will not start enumerating the list of great pieces of luck which I had in my career, but there are so many that I sometimes feel it's like the world is full of great pieces, like big cakes of luck to be uncovered.
I wonder if you thought this was a particularly French book. Obviously, now it's in English. It began as Théorème Vivant. But the notion of the public intellectual who is more than just one thing, more than just a physicist or a historian, but someone who has culture générale, you tell us about your great love of music. Would you hesitate to say that there is something about French cultural and intellectual life that nourishes people such as you?
I think so. And actually, when it was when the book was out for examination by the English-speaking world, for instance, for the translation. The book has been translated in maybe 10 languages, something like that. But the first reviewer for the English, I don't remember if it was for the English or the American companies. Anyway, it was the same team working on this at the beginning, and the reviewer wrote in his review, "This is a very French book." A very French novel.
And not just because you mentioned how hard it is to get good cheese at Princeton.
No, because of the general style. The person who wrote the review said said it was a marvelous book. I was so pleased. Said there was obviously was somebody with some experience in the academic world, or maybe an academic, and said that he or she could relate to every single chapter in the book, and also said that it's a very French novel in the way it is constructed and the style. Actually, the translation process was quite tricky. And
I wondered about this.
Yes. It is Malcolm de Beauvoise, whom you mentioned, who did the translation. It's usually in most languages, when it was translated by a team, a mathematician paired with somebody more with the literature. But he could do both. He has some mathematical training, and he did a wonderful job with this. But we worked very hard to reproduce the shades of the language, and I had Malcolm rewrite his translation completely twice. And he was suffering, for instance, There is this, we have this usual idea that English is more compact than French, and usually it's true, but when you really know the words and the context and so on, you can have very compact French sentences, and poor Malcolm was going to long English sentences to try and reproduce the exact
nuance,
yes, the shades of words that were in there. In almost every respect, I'm totally satisfied with the result. There are two or three sentences which we gave up, translating the way they reproducing kind of the shade that they were in between. But translating is such a difficult thing. You know this quote saying that translation is the language of Europe. And we live in an area in which it's true that global English has won the war of being the language of communication
for
worldwide.
Now.
For now, except in except part of I'm very much involved in activities in Africa, and French remain about almost as important as English in
of
that
course.
Part of the world.
Yes.
But that's only the communication language that you use to communicate at a rather technical or superficial level. When it comes to communicating the context and the nuance and everything that is in the word, you need to translate in the mother tongue. And for this is in this area, this era in which subtle things are so important nowadays, because everything is in the information, everything is in the impression, and so on. Translation is certainly more important than ever. I think translators have beautiful days to come still.
It is such a creative work that to understand the heart of what is being said as well as the details. And, you know, I think of many conversations that are reproduced in the book and how little exchanges between you and your partner Claire, and how
yes.
you just a few words are reported, or the humor when you talk about the children as lambkins or things like
yes.
this. And the wrong expression could make you sound 100 years old or
yes.
10 years old. And
Yes, depending whether it's an old world or so on. There are other things to be said in this. First, there was the problem of the emails.
Ah, yes.
So difficult for several reasons. Because this is an email conversation between two
Clément.
Mathematicians. This is with Clément Mouhot, who worked on me on the result of Landau damping. This was a totally shared achievement. And when you are making work for publication, there is technical material, but technical words on which everybody agrees. But when you work with your collaborator, there is your own jargon
right.
special which has developed and that you use in the email, and it's neither technical for publication, neither something that is common tongue. It's most difficult to translate. And the other remark concerning the translation, about the translation, is the cultural references, for which Malcolm worked on making a series of footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
Because some things which are meant to be in a French context, for instance, I would at some points quote, without quoting it explicitly, a verse from a French song.
Everyone reading it would know in France what it
well,
was.
Well, not everyone. Everyone
is
in the generation, but some people will recognize it's a,
yes.
it's a verse for the song. And English reader will not. So footnote, not footnote, but note at the end of the book we use for this.
The endnotes are actually a great education in and of themselves. And I should say to anyone listening that if you feel that understanding Landau damping may be beyond you at this point, you can have an education in a very wonderful collection of Francophone singer-songwriters, performers, by reading what Cedric is listening to. There are some great musical treasures in there, that as well as English language artists. This book has a lot of highs and lows in it. This adventure, as you say, has the traditional narrative arc. There is a challenge, the défi, the difficulty, and then the resolution. But Even getting toward the end of the book, Cedric, I knew that the problem must be solved or there perhaps would not be a book, but it was nail-biting until the end. I had no idea that mathematicians of your eminence had such a hard time.
It is such hard time, and thinking like, gosh, but there's a mistake. No, it's okay, wait, well, we can repair it. No, that's, and so on. Even my wife, who was one of the very first readers looking at this, she was like, but come on, is it true or not your theorem in the end?
Are you exaggerating? Are you dramatic?
yeah, that was the thing, because there are some parts. One of the scenes I describe, for instance, in an airport, in which I suddenly realize some intermediate result is too good to be true. Now, if we are proving this, then the proof has to be false. And then she, well, gosh, and the impression I use is the airport is kind of shaking around me, because you are here like, what is it? You are going to a conference to present the result, and in the airport you realize there might be a big mistake in there.
Ah.
And but in the end it all finishes well, you know. But it's like in adventure movie. If there is not a moment in which you are near death for the hero, then you don't fully appreciate the happy ending.
I suppose with any grand challenge, we realize the mountain must be high or the accomplishment is not great. But this cycle of exaltation and sometimes depression that you talk about, do you think this is peculiar to mathematics or to science or to creativity generally, that some of us might think, oh, I've seen that film, A Beautiful Mind, and I've seen lots of films about brilliant mathematicians who have terrible emotional depression. Is it something about maths, or do you think it's common to...
I think it's rather common to all creative jobs. Maybe there are some peculiarities, because we are always striving to make this construction totally rigorous, and that is so tricky. And, you know, until the very end, if some bit is wrong, the whole collapses. It's not like you're writing this song and maybe there is one or two chords which are not right, but it doesn't make it a problem to the whole song. But in math, if there is one argument which is not right, the whole may collapse. That's the really tricky thing. Apart from that, I think it's rather general. I was giving as part of this series of conversation for the publishing of the book, I was giving a talk at the Royal Institution and about the problem of the birth of ideas, illustrating it with many mathematical anecdotes from me, but also from other great people, well, from great people. And some of the listeners, some people in the audience told me, yes, it was about math, but it was about everything. I can relate to this. And the same, one of my friends who is a photographer told me it could relate to everything, because of the creative process, that's all the same ingredients and the same problems you have to overcome. So I think it's rather general to these creative works in which it doesn't go smoothly. It's a very chaotic process, and that's an important one, because this is where the new stuff arises from.
I wonder how, obviously we know your life has changed since the Fields Medal, not least the 4 hours you talk about after discovering, after receiving the award, being on the phone, answering essentially the same question to all of us poor journalists who we are condemned to ask the same questions of great people. But specifically how your life has changed since this book, whether it's the fashion shoots, things like, as you say, talking to everyone from garbage men to presidents,
yes,
as you mentioned in your TEDx talk, or being on Canal Plus, mainstream TV, talking to Laurent Ruquier on N'est pas couché, where of course, like all of us journalists, we are obliged to say, hey, Cedric, what difference does this make in the real world? And so you are receiving friendly but also kind of harsh questions because it's the job of the interviewer. Isn't that really tiring to hear again, you know, Cedric, I don't know anything about math and it's quite boring. What difference? And then you must smile and look elegant and say, well, Laurent.
Laurent, nobody's perfect. Let's say that it became quite more interesting after the book. The book gave people quite some material to talk about and start for many discussions. After the Fields Medal, yes, the journalists were kind of obliged to ask all the same questions and how does it feel to get this reward and explain us in layman's term what you've done and so on. It was always the same questions. And after the book, the questions kind of diversified and we could go on to more general problems and ideas. And also, I was involved in a bunch of projects. So after the Fields Medal, I became involved in a number of projects. It was not a problem to find this project. It was a problem just to select from everything that was offered to me. And so in the past few years, I've been involved in some projects of cooperation with Africa. I was mentioning this moments ago, in particular being on the advisory board of two big Pan-African projects. So each year I go at least 2 weeks in sub-Saharan Africa to teach and lecture and discuss strategy, whatever. I've been involved in the development of my institute, Institut Henri Poincaré, and just a few weeks ago arrived the good news that I was getting in public funding all the money that I needed for extending the institute, renovating an additional old building, constructing a new museum of science inside.
14 million euros,
A good 14 million euros, which nowadays is not so easy to get in public funding, right? So on top of that, I also am involved in fundraising some private money for the running the institute and so on. So in contact with many companies, industries. I've also been involved in involved in politics, first as vice president of a think tank which specializes in European issues. I am a federalist, this is the word. Okay. I believe future of Europe lies in better integration and better coordination in the respect of the cultures of any country of this beautiful continent. And I also was the president of the support committee for the election of the current mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo. So she's a friend and so on.
Quite a change and an achievement in Paris. First woman mayor, if I'm
absolutely
correct.
Absolutely. And I tell you, she will be a great mayor. She has already started to be. And also, I've been involved in as president of an association with a fabulous artist and engineer who is has a story in music. He was the partner and fellow musician of Catherine Ribeiro, who was in the
great heroine of yours.
That's right.
A photo in your office, I believe, along with a bust of Poincaré.
That's absolutely true. And Patrice is also an extraordinary man, so has been designing these wonderful new music instruments for many years, which have many use and can be used in research in music, but also very powerful in engaging disabled people for playing and improvising. And so we are organizing concerts, developing and so on. And so I'm president of this association now. So fundraising, getting some new experiments done, etc. A lot of work, but extremely interesting in the meeting of when creativity means the need for organization. You know, if there is not this creative spark, as Patrice has, nothing occurs. But if it's pure creativity, nothing occurs either, because you need to get the funding, you need to get the place to make this, you need to get the connection and so on. This requires organization. So this has been quite interesting. I'm also spokesperson for the project of World Fair that France will apply to for 2025. So a lot of things and some other committees, whatever. This has been extraordinarily enriching. And I've was able to work on various other book projects. In a few weeks,
a BD, graphic novel.
In a few weeks, a graphic novel will be coming out. It's a project with an artist that I really admire. His name is Baudouin. Very dense and rich drawings. Something that mixes reflection about creativity and human organization and Second World War as some kind of focal point in this. Alan Turing is one of the heroes of this graphic novel. But the four heroes all have something to do with the UK, actually.
And so your collaboration with Baudouin, you're supplying the text or...?
Roughly speaking, I'm doing the text and he's doing the images. But there has been constant interaction between the two of us. Actually, in the elements of our collaboration, I recognize many of the elements of my collaboration with Clément that is described in the
book.
Like
sending emails on Christmas Day, for example?
Yes, that was like these kind of things. So everyday email exchange with Edmond and arguing about this drawing and please redo this and let's work on that and let me rewrite this chapter while you are working on that other one, etc. And a very intense bond between the two of us. I am the kind of person developing bonds through collaborative, intense and emotional work.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Institut, where you are director. In the book, you discuss being faced with a choice of institutions. You were at the École Normale Supérieure in Lyon. You spent some time at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton, where the greatest minds come to find no good cheese.
What a place.
And you agree, we learn in the course of the book, to take on the directorship of the Institut Henri Poincaré, and you are also at Claude Bernard University in Lyon. Now, the Institute is very special and unusual, you've told me, because of the way it works. There are no...
Yes, no permanent professors there.
What a nightmare! You mentioned it took years to get things into shape.
And it did. I believe for any serious project you're undertaking, results start to be visible after 4 to 5 years, and that was the length of my first term at the Institut. The second term has started. And indeed, I learned to do all these things. It's handling human resources, that's the most tricky part of it all. When you have the human resources under control, all the rest will follow. And you have to think of the building, you have to think of the money, you have to think of the organization, the public representation, and so on. There was no PR, no public relation department when I started. We founded it. There was no media service. We also founded it. We produced a movie last year. We really did the work on the organization. And at several times we had problem with a missing person, with some sickness, etc. And we held it together. And several times we were saved, like it was that close from a crash. And then it worked in the end. And important in this is that you are always confident you will find a solution. It's a bit like when you're fighting with the theorem. And so this has been a really great experience also for me, this. It reminded me a little bit, maybe you will smile, of my experience as the head of the students' union in École Normale Supérieure. I was 20 years old and the head of the students' union. Well, it's some quite
it's
interesting
a great job.
Job
when you like music and theatre. And
and all the human organization side. And so this has been extremely interesting. Needless to say that when you do all these activities enriching as they are, you cannot continue the same amount of engagement in the mathematical research as there was in the book. It's just humanly impossible for your body and so on. But I did keep the teaching, and I consider myself even more a professor than a researcher.
Really?
I did keep the teaching. You know, of all the French mathematicians who get the Fields Medal, I, and there are many of them, I am the only one who never had a pure research position. I always had a teaching position. And it's important for me. And so I continued to do teaching, on subjects such that every year I had to learn something to teach it. This year I recorded my first MOOC. It was a great experience also. I had three other MOOCs planned for the coming years, and so on. And that is very important to me. It's my way to continue learning and teaching every year.
It's an act of great generosity to teaching is an act of generosity, is it not? And many scholars, of course, remember important lecturers to them. And it's an act of great generosity to be the person who is directing such an important institution. Well, I think a lot of academics are maybe tempted to be a little more selfish and say, I'll leave the running in the organization to someone who is not a researcher, and the teaching to other people. But I've got to discover the next great mathematical discovery. Leave me alone.
You can, that's one way to say it, but I would be much more lenient. First, you know, I did both. And the book, at some point, my colleagues in Lyon want me to take the directorship, and I refuse at that point, because at that point I needed full concentration on my research. I believe there are periods in life in which you do this and periods in which you do that. And it's okay to spend some years doing in what can be considered a bit of selfish way, just your research. If at other periods in your life you are fully engaged in some collective activity, administration work or so. Also, let me note that both in the teaching and the institute, I do have good conditions, especially now at the institute. There is an administrator in charge of the most administrative part so that I can more focus on the strategy. In terms of teaching, I insisted on keeping it always, but still this is reduced teaching. It's not that enormous load of teaching which we can have. I was lucky enough to never have a full load of teaching. Even when I was in École Normale Supérieure for my first professor job, it was something like 100 hours a year of lectures in front of the students. That already is quite a big amount of work to prepare seriously. But some people have 130 hours. Some people have even more than that. It can be an enormous, enormous toll. And so I certainly don't blame at all all the professors who think they have a too high teaching load. It's all in having the right amount.
I wonder what you... Obviously, you're at a very special institution in the higher education system
in
France.
Yes, I forgot to tell about this. So, Institut Henri Poincaré is an invitation-only institution. There are no permanent professors, no permanent researchers, apart from the director and the deputy director. Institut Henri Poincaré is proud of being the second oldest international mathematics institution in the world after the Mittag-Leffler Institute in Sweden. And it has had highs and lows, as every institution, or almost. And it was refounded in the 90s after something like 20 years of being abandoned by mathematical research. And when it was refounded, it was on the same principles as that institute, which was quite new at the time, in California, the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute, founded by the great mathematician Chern. And the principle was as this, so just director and deputy director, and all the rest are visitors. But there is a staff taking everything into, taking charge of everything. So the staff is something like 25 people. Of course, there is the IT persons, there are the people in charge of the PR, the people in charge of the organization and logistics, the people in charge of the library, and so on and so forth. And we are also, so in addition to that, we are also home of all the national institutions for mathematics in France. So the learned societies have their headquarters and their offices in our institute. We have 10 in-house institutions which are partners of us. And we also organize a lot of public relation. We have a cine club running every year nowadays, in which we are in collaboration with one of these beautiful cinemas, movie theaters from the 5th district in Paris.
Oh, lovely.
So we have these, project this movie, have a discussion, debate with scientists and so on. It's always full. We are organizing exhibitions. We are editing books and so on. And we have in the making for the years to come a Museum of Science, which will be incorporated. And the originality of the project is that we will have in the same place, center to Paris and center to the cultural ecosystem, we have at the same place the research and the pedagogy and the industry. Because we will be presenting also new technologies, explaining where the math comes into this for everybody interested to appreciate.
So for the agenda of public engagement and relations with business, all of this is tied into
Absolutely.
One place.
All this tied into one place. So this is a tricky thing to organize, but we want it to be the way French like ideally the things to be done, that is with great centralization, but at the same time in an ecosystemic way.
I wondered if you would say, if you could, obviously your involvement with Anne Hidalgo, it shows that you think, I'm sure, about how politics can improve our lives, it can be a force for good. You must think also about the potential for changes that the government could make to make things better for the French higher education system. Looking at it as a whole, if you could be president, I know you haven't got time, but if you could have the influence on the future prime minister and president of France, what would you like to see change in French higher education? Just more money, more universities, fewer universities, more special institutes, different to the grandes écoles, more diverse intake at grandes écoles, maybe?
The grandes écoles system has its drawbacks, but it doesn't work so bad and has brought many of the great results of France. Some of the grandes écoles are in slight crisis. That's the case of École Polytechnique, who is one of our historic great schools, but torn between the desire to reinforce its scientific potential and the appetite for more, you know, jobs in business type, management type, and so on. That's one of the problems we have, but the Grandes Écoles system is not doing bad. Certainly, we have a problem with the selection at universities and the fact there is no selection.
There is no selection.
Okay, for the moment it is agreed that it cannot be any selection at the entrance of French universities. That seems to be agreed on. I am quite skeptical about this. There might be some acceptable way to do some selection, but we are having some big trouble with this. The fact that universities are now autonomous in a way was a big progress. It had to be done. This was realized by the previous government. It is very tricky then, because universities are lacking the human and the human resources to do this, the culture, the money to do the transition. So it's very tricky. The capitalization of the French universities is very, very low compared to that of the big universities from the English world, or even more so, of course, from the American world. There is a factor of 1,000 maybe between the capitalization of a great French university and a great American university. And so we are quite fragile in this respect. The prestige is still there, but the money is not. That's one issue we have. Now, another thing that could be that should be said is we are facing a big problem of human resources in the sense of students. In sciences, less and less students in the universities, in hardcore sciences, so to speak. This might be our main problem nowadays. This is not a problem that you solve just with money. It's a problem that you solve with the culture, with the public engagement, with the speech, and I hope that initiatives like the museum I was talking about will help reduce this gap and convince more and more young people we need them in the sciences. That's a kind of message for everybody to work on. You mentioned the issue of how many universities. Certainly we have too many, but closing a university is nearly impossible. Once it has been there, you have to do with it. And we see it, how easy it is to split a university and how difficult it is to put them together back. So difficult.
Do you think some of the initiatives, such as bringing Paris universities together in a kind of super Sorbonne, or allying different universities, perhaps in Lyon or other places, is that good? Or is it saying, hello, you will share your kitchen with the people from next door? They're going to be using the same kettle as you. What do you think?
Well, it's somewhere in between the rosy view and the pessimistic view. But there is some good element in this. It forced people to think about the governance and the organization and coordination. You know, there are some big examples, internationally well-known, of federal organization universities. University of California is one famous example with these famous universities. Yes. I still dream of the day there will be a unified Paris university that would all of a sudden become the biggest, most powerful in terms of brain university in the world. Historically, why do we have these universities fighting against each other and so on? It's a consequence of the events of May 68, when government realized what a powerful force universities were and how dangerous this was. Of course, president of Paris University would be quite more powerful than any minister could throw up a government if all the forces were united behind him or her. And this was perceived as a threat that had to be fought with the usual strategy
divide
of
divide and conquer.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. But nowadays we realize university is not only something that can be a nuisance to the government, it's also something that is of tremendous importance in the global world competition. And so there is need for more unification. That's a recent realization from the political world. And but it is very much, very much so nowadays. And I still dream of the future in which there could be a University of Paris.
That sounds like a good dream. And would there be a place for the Institut Henri Poincaré in there, or would you
Sure. And since you Poincaré, technically is already within the ecosystem. Since we have two mother institutions, one is CNRS and one is University, Pierre and Marie Curie, Paris 6 University, which is together with Orsay University, the biggest science university in France. And it's important for us to have this double roof, so to speak, CNRS research and university, professors and so on. We have scientific independence. We have our own scientific board, choice of activities, etc. But we know we can count on CNRS and the University Pierre and Marie Curie to help us. It's good when you are small to be held by very big friends. I mean, to speak concretely in terms of budget, maybe budget of University Pierre and Marie Curie is must be 200 times the budget of Institut Poincaré, and budget of CNRS is even more than that. So we are tiny respect to this in terms of means, but we do have some influence and some impact in our field. So it's also important for them to have a good handling of our projects.
May I ask if there will be another book soon? I know you're still busy talking about this one.
Yes, there is the graphic novel I was talking about, which will be out beginning April in France. That's a project in which I invested a lot of myself.
And the title of this book is?
Les Rêveurs Lunaires.
The Lunar Dreamers.
The Lunar Dreamers. Actually, the idea for the title came when I was reading this account of how Leo Szilard in London had the idea of the chain reaction for the atomic bomb. And this was after hearing a lecture by Rutherford, the father of atomic physics, in which Rutherford had declared that anybody who would like to extract energy from the atom would be talking moonshine. And I was unable to find a good French translation for talking moonshine. And then, of course, there is the idea of dream and the idea of moon, and that's a common thread between the various heroes in this book. So the moon is there as a symbol of both the dream and, you know, the fact that it's there forever and looking in a kind of with a little smile at all our futile attempts to act and work and think and create and so on. But that is what we live for. So Rêveurs Lunaires, that's the title coming out. There is another project with Grasset taking the form of an ABC, you know? A for analysis, B for Boltzmann, C, etc. And each of them will have a few pages of discussion in relation to my personal history or what I can say about it. And it will be illustrated by a world-class calligrapher with these days the art of beautiful writing is all the more enhanced as we are always typing on very stereotyped characters. And so I found it was interesting to have this association with somebody from the calligraphic world. This guy is also a wonderful artist and scholar, that calligrapher. And recently we had the book on the Institut Henri Poincaré out. It was called The House of Mathematics, La Maison des Mathématiques, a book about how is the life of a mathematical research institute nowadays in all its respects. So we talk about the history of the place, how it is run, the budget, the relation, the events, the relation of mathematics to other sciences. There are some testimonies from various people about the institute, and there are a bunch of photographs which are illustrating very much what is this life. So this I'm very proud to notice that during last Christmas, we were briefly at the number one position in the sales in the category of Science for Everybody. This was kind of it was an institutional book, the kind of, say, institution counterpart of Birth of a Theorem, which was from the point of view of the individual.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining me, Cedric Villani. We have been discussing Birth of a Theorem, a Mathematical Adventure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.